climate change on the music playlist? Oh, sure, it's an oldie.
Well, no way, he built himself an ark. There's one wild river to cross. He built it all from the hickory bark. One wild river to cross.
Noah and the Ark, vengeful God, floods, disasters, animals on boats. Nah, it's a climate change story. Looking back at history, humanity has been dealing with climate change for much of civilization. It turns out we could learn a lot from the past about Hollywood's favorite biblical-scale catastrophe, global warming. It's not only a movie. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, July 8th, and we are going to take a look at climate change and economics with Freakonomics author Stephen Dubner. The 2008 presidential election looks a lot like the 1976 presidential election, or so some argue. Also, GM shedding brands and people is a new business model next. Buying a slave, it's illegal but very easy to do. And summer songs, what makes your heart sing when the sun's shining? That and all the news. Two earthquakes have struck this morning in Peru and Japan. Both measure at magnitude 6. In Peru, the U.S. Geological Survey says the quake was close to the border between Bolivia and Chile. In Japan, the earthquake hit off the south coast of Okinawa. There are no immediate reports of injuries for either quake. On the other side of Japan, day two of the G8 summit has almost wrapped up in Hokkaido. President Bush had a private and, he says, productive meeting with German Chancellor Angela Merkel.
We talked about a lot of common problems and a lot of common opportunities. We talked about the G8. We talked about the need to continue to work together on Iran. Angela Merkel is a constructive force for good.
The G8 leaders have reached a compromise today on global warming. They're endorsing a 50% cut in greenhouse gases by the middle of this century. They stop short of tougher targets in the near future.
Accusations fly after a suicide bomber killed 41 people and wounded nearly 150 others in Kabul yesterday. Afghanistan says it has evidence proving a Pakistani agency was behind the attack. Pakistan's prime minister is denying any involvement, saying his country has no interest in destabilizing Afghanistan. Adora?
The White House is downplaying statements by Iraq's Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki calling for a timetable for a withdrawal of U.S. troops. The White House opposes any specific timetable for American forces to leave Iraq.
So oil's up and slightly in Asian trading. The S&P begins at 1252 today. On the campaign trail, Barack Obama holds a town meeting in Powder Springs, Georgia, and John McCain heads to Western Pennsylvania this evening.
And we're thinking summer songs.
Oh, yeah.
Is there a definitive song this year that says summer to you? 877-8-MY-TAKE, and we got a response.
Hi, it's Catherine. I'm from Harlem, and the song that I like, I can't remember the name of it, but it goes, hot down, summer in the city.
We found the song. It's Summer in the City by Lovin' Spoonful.
Lovin' Spoonful. That's mid-60s, but what do you think about this summer? Definitive summer songs of this or any summer at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
This decade, last decade, the decade before that.
No umbrellas, please. No umbrellas, please.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. If it's possible to say, we begin with something bigger than news this morning. The broadly deteriorating U.S. economy has suddenly become a transformative theme of American life. Both presidential candidates are presenting their economic plans this week. John McCain is focused on shrinking the government sector, broadly lowering taxes and deficits. Barack Obama is calling for additional stimulus to keep Americans buying. Changes in trade policy. He's calling for lowering taxes for the middle class. But there's a sense, and I think you feel it just like I do, that the trends in the economy are out in front of both candidates. And in a moment, we're going to look at echoes of the troubled economic 1970s in this historic presidential campaign. Remember, back then there was inflation, energy problems, issues in the Middle East as well. But first, it used to be that when General Motors sneezed, the whole U.S. economy got a bad cold. It's probably good that no one says that anymore, because GM is perhaps facing the worst crisis of its existence right now. Stock at more than half-century lows, sales plummeting, big job cuts, plant closures already announced. Now the Wall Street Journal reports that in advance of a crucial meeting in early August, the company has started to completely rethink its business. I mean, what is that like? What does that even mean? He wrote the book, co-wrote the book, Freakonomics. Our friend Stephen Dubner is here. And Stephen, I mean, the CEO of General Motors, I mean, put us in the mind of that guy. I mean, the head of one of the most traditionally stable businesses in the U.S. having to rethink his entire business. What does that even mean?
Well, that's hard to say. My first thought is panic. This is why capitalism is often called creative destruction. Okay, I think when you're in a short term, when you're in a period right now where there's short term worry or panic across the board in the economy, I think one of the healthiest things to do is take a long view and see what it means. Okay.
Well, the fact that they're even doing that pushed GM's price up 7% yesterday.
Absolutely.
It was interesting.
Here's something that's fun to do. Go to your favorite stock trading site and type in the long term stock prices for three companies: General Motors, Eastman Kodak, and IBM, okay? And guess which one is up in the three?
GM.
IBM.
IBM.
Why has IBM done relatively very well over the past 30, 40 years, while GM and Eastman Kodak have not? It's because when IBM was known for making typewriters, what were they also doing? They were also figuring out how to make computers, and then computers became the thing, and they did it.
So it's looking ahead.
Even then they had to adapt again even more recently when they sold off their laptop business, which was an interesting move and which was widely criticized, and which turned out to be a fantastic move. They sold it off to Lenovo, a Chinese company. So now they make their money selling big computer servers and software. What Eastman Kodak faced was, holy cow, digital cameras. How are we going to make money at that? Let's try to figure it out. What GM is facing now is, hey, people aren't buying big cars. What are we going to do? Let's figure it out. You got to
scramble. Perhaps they should have faced it before. So the issue is not so much transformations in the economy, even though that's news. It's a corporation's inability to think forward enough
to
adapt.
It's easy for us to say that, but my goodness, these are hard problems. What we're facing right now are a few things happening at once that don't often happen at once. We're seeing big behavior change. The American public is finally driving less. This has never happened.
Well, it's even bigger than that. The highest selling car, the Ford Explorer, is now not even on the charts.
Right.
And that is in 1 year that happened.
It's probably a lot of the reason for why this behavior change has happened is people like us, right? If the media tells you over and over again, gas is so expensive, how on earth can you afford to drive? Even though gas still comprises a relatively very minor share of most people's budgets. Most people's, okay?
But it's not just the media. I mean, for example, there was this week a Merrill Lynch analyst who said it's not impossible to imagine that GM would be filing for bankruptcy. There was immediate responses from other analysts who said that's not the case. They have billions of dollars of cash on hand. They just need to figure out what their future looks like.
Absolutely. My point here is that drivers have made a big shift for the first time in a long time. If you look at total miles driven over the last 6 or 8 months, they're actually down. That never happens in this country, in part because we have more and more people, more and more cars, more and more roads. Now you're seeing $4 gas has been this mental point where people have hit it and said, holy cow, I am going to change it. And then that changes the market.
Well, so what does GM do? Do they get into bicycles? I mean, let's talk about Adora's bankruptcy point for a moment. Is there a difference between actual bankruptcy and the perception of bankruptcy? When everyone thinks you're bankrupt, it's kind of the same thing.
Well, yeah, there is a difference. But I mean, this is the danger of being a slow-moving industry in a fast-moving economy. And that's life, and that's why it is called creative destruction. Look, when I said I take the long view, here's what I mean. There are a lot of people in America right now who are feeling that global capitalism is really bad news. And all I would say is, when you're feeling that way, it's probably good to take a step back and think. It reminds me a little bit of what Churchill said about democracy. Democracy is the worst form of government, Churchill said, except for all those other forms that have been tried from time to time.
Right, but GM can't say that about the auto industry, because there are other industries that are actually really better.
Can I also say this? As patriotic as one may be, as patriotic as you guys may be, as concerned as you may be for GM, it is not our job to make GM succeed. This is what happens in capitalism.
It's their job, right. All right, Stephen Dubner, a co-author of Freakonomics, describing the Freakonomics experience of General Motors trying to rethink its business. Joining us now is Gideon Rachman, who's the chief foreign affairs commentator for the Financial Times. Gideon is in London. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
We alluded to it at the top of the hour. You see potential echoes of the 1970s, both in what's going on in the U.S. economy and particularly what's going on in the U.S. presidential campaign. Back in 1976, it was Carter versus Ford. Of course, it's Obama versus McCain right now. Describe what the echoes are that you think are particularly relevant.
Well, I should perhaps explain that in a sense I'm kind of reliving my childhood. I was living in California in 1976, and it was my introduction to American politics, and it was incredibly absorbing. And the thing that I remember was this huge excitement around Carter as this new figure who promised a kind of moral renewal for the U.S. And I think some of the reasons that people were looking for a Carter figure, an outsider who promised renewal, are similar to the reasons that people are looking positively at Obama. America had an energy crisis. It had just emerged from the Vietnam War. You have the parallels with the Iraq War now. And also there was a sense that the U.S. had kind of lost its way morally, that there were these hearings in Congress at the time about the CIA's involvement in nefarious dealings overseas, which I think have some echoes with the hearings about Guantanamo now.
You also have echoes on the Republican side. You have Gerald Ford back then, sort of one step removed from the most discredited president of the 20th century, and now you've got John McCain sort of one step removed from George W. Bush.
Absolutely, and both, you know, having this difficult business of trying to distance themselves from a Republican predecessor, and it didn't really work for Ford in the end, and it doesn't look at the moment that it's working for McCain.
Well, a Carter analogy to Barack Obama isn't exactly a positive story for the Obama campaign. Do you actually think that Obama is conceivably likely to turn out like Jimmy Carter?
No, I mean, well, it's difficult to say. Let's put it that way, because obviously there are differences. I think that maybe a better way of thinking about it is that the Obama people, if and when they get into the White House, will have to think quite hard about, well, what went wrong for Jimmy Carter and how can we avoid that? And I think that trying to break down the problems of the Carter presidency, I think there was an air of panic at times over energy. Carter gave this speech in 1977 when he said rather incredibly that, you know, we could use up all the oil in the world within 10 years. I think Carter was perhaps too pessimistic a figure. I mean, he had lots of integrity, but he gave the famous malaise speech in 1979 where he said, you know, we've lost a sense of meaning in our own lives. And I think, to be fair, Obama has learnt those lessons. He's deliberately very, very optimistic. You know, the whole hope campaign is really perhaps owes more to Reagan than to Carter.
Gideon, one of the amazing things about the piece that you wrote last week where you did make this comparison to Jimmy Carter and Barack Obama is that this election, like 1976, is perhaps more about the electorate of America than it is about the candidates. It's what we want in this time of crisis that either reveals something about us or reveals certain contradictions in American life.
Sure. Well, I suppose in all democracies, ultimately, it comes down to what the electorate wants. But I think you're right. There's a sort of volatile mood at the moment. I mean, I think there's always been a taste in American politics for the outsider, but at times of perceived crisis, particularly when there's a simultaneous problems in the domestic economy and in America's standing overseas, there is a desire to say, look, let's start afresh, let's go for somebody new. And I think in that respect, Obama's campaign and his appeal are rather similar to those of Carter. But I think another, talking about the lessons that Obama's people have to learn, I think the other one they have to learn, obviously, is that Carter went into foreign policy with all sorts of good intentions about talking to foreign leaders, using personal diplomacy. And sometimes it worked. It worked quite well on the Camp David peace accords, which I guess were Carter's greatest achievement. But it ended up with him looking rather naive. And I think that's a parallel that Obama has to watch.
Gideon Rachman, thank you very much. Gideon is the chief foreign affairs commentator for the Financial Times. Stephen Dubner, of course, is staying with us. The interesting thing is the Obama has the advantage that he can learn from Carter. Carter didn't have that advantage.
Really interesting to see what people do, what the voters do, given some of the same pressures that existed in 76 existing today.
Echoes from the 70s.
Yeah.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. We've been asking for definitive summer songs this morning, and everybody's a DJ. Martha in New York says by email, "Light My Fire" by The Doors. That's a good one. Here's another one.
Hi, my name is Mary Leggio. I'm calling from New York City, and Summertime is Hot Fun in the Summertime by Sly and the Family Stone.
Who else is a DJ out there? Call us at 877-8-MYTAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
And in other news developments today, world leaders at the GA summit seem to have come to a compromise on global warming, endorsing a 50% cut in greenhouse gases by the middle of the century. This, of course, in the midst of a year where we have seen deadly food riots, droughts, earthquakes, heat waves, and cyclones, all which have triggered questions about global warming. Stephen Dubner, co-author of the book Freakonomics, has joined us. Stephen, there's a new study which takes a good hard look at global warming. What did the authors say about how warming will affect different economies?
Yeah, it's a fascinating paper that talks about how global warming will affect worldwide economies, okay? And the short answer is that it will affect economies differently because heat happens in different places. Heat does different things in different places. But the bottom line is that poor countries, no surprise here, but it's empirically argued, poor countries will suffer far more than rich countries as a result of climate change.
The correlations are really stark, though. I mean, you know, like temperature to civil war. Describe that, if you could.
So I don't want to bore you with too much detail, but there's a really fascinating body of literature within economics, agricultural economics, development economics, and so on, in which economists look for what you'd call shocks to the system. When you try to measure, for instance, why does a civil war happen in Africa? When you try to measure, for instance, why does a drought happen in Bavaria in the 18th century? It's very hard to pinpoint reasons because so many things happen at one time. Just as right now the our political candidates are trying to argue about how to pull the economy up, there's so many things happening in an economy that to say if I press one button, it will change everything. If it happens to change things, then you can argue that was the button that worked. But in fact, there were 100 other things working. So what economists try to do is isolate things. And they've made some very, very clever empirical studies of how things work. In one, looking at civil war in Africa, they found that drought is the single greatest predictor of a future civil war. Now, this makes sense. When you're dealing with agricultural economies, if you've got a drought half a season or two seasons or three seasons later, you've got food shortages. Half a season or a month later, you've got political instability. Boom, you've got civil war.
And then there's the notion that that civil war in that country is going to trickle out to others. Let's look at a current example, which is in Haiti in April. The prime minister essentially had to step down in the face of massive food riots.
Yeah, food. Look, as much as we've been focusing on energy in media reporting in general, food is the other half of the story, and energy and food very much go together.
And more socially immediate. I mean, people, then the fuel issue.
Well, yes and no. I mean, talk to someone who's who's going to pay triple for heating oil, who's living in a cold climate this year, and that's going to be pretty socially immediate this winter. But yes, food is also food is an easier problem to solve in some ways than energy. But the point of this new paper, these three economists, I just want to name them, Melissa Dell, Ben Jones, and Ben Olkin. What they did was a very clever way of trying to measure the actual impact of temperature change. They looked back at temperature and precipitation data for every country in the world for the last 50 years and then compare that to economic growth in those countries. And they find that for poor countries, a rise of temperature of about 1 degree Celsius results in a growth shock, a negative growth shock of about 1% to the economy. And you get warmer, your economy has trouble. But that's only in poor countries. Rich countries adapt. We have many more resources to adapt to these things. So that's the real story there.
So Hollywood teaches us that global warming and climate change is going to involve some giant planetary scale disaster. You're saying, no, it's going to be something much more, we're all pitted against each other.
Look, I don't want to be a total freak alarmist here.
Yes, you do.
Because that sounds like Armageddon is what
but if you want it, if you are the kind of person who likes to think apocalyptically, right, and you're an American, you have the wrong vision, okay? Because if you're an American and you think apocalyptically, you think, holy cow, the mountains come crashing down, the seas come rising, we don't grow food, we don't heat our homes, that's probably not going to happen. What's going to happen is in poor countries, they will suffer unduly, and people from poor countries will be streaming to get into every country that's rich enough to adapt. Now, that probably doesn't surprise us so much if we think about it in a macro way, but what these economists have done is tried to look at the past to envision what climate change might mean for the future, and we may have been envisioning the wrong kind of apocalypse that global warming could bring, if it does bring one.
The amazing thing, though, and what I love about what you've written, is that the answers are from history, which means they're more in front of us than they are some visionary science fiction future.
It is true, and this is one of the strengths that economics can bring. But I don't want to overpromise the ability of economists to predict the future any more than climatologists, any more than psychics, frankly, because predicting the future is a fool's game.
But essentially, the takeaway very quickly here is the interconnectedness of it all. In other words, it's not just about the weather. It's about what the weather then triggers. If you're talking about drought, you're talking about less crops. If you're talking about less crops and there's less food, it's less food that's imported or exported. You're talking about all of these interrelated issues then trigger a bigger problem.
You're also talking about fear and weird little fringe effects. I'll give you two examples. During the mini ice age 400 or 500 years ago, when it got colder suddenly, women were accused of being witches who'd caused the cold, and there were witches being strung up all over Europe. Okay? Panic that's unrelated to reality.
We're going to leave it there. Stephen Dubner, thank you. Stephen is the author of the Freakonomics book and blog co-author, and he's staying with us right now. We're turning to Femi Oke for the latest headlines. Femi.
Hello there. Just gone 28 minutes past the hour. Six Nation talks on North Korea's nuclear weapons resume later this week. That's after North Korea turned over information about its nuclear program and disabled its main atomic facility more than a week ago. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac shares plunged to their lowest in nearly 14 years yesterday. And a magnitude 6.0 earthquake shakes southern Peru, while another earthquake shook southern Japan off the coast of Okinawa. There were no immediate reports of injuries from either quake. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke says the Fed is considering giving squeezed Wall Street firms more time to draw emergency loans directly from the central bank to help them overcome credit problems. The presidential candidates are showcasing their economic plans. John McCain says his plan is to cut taxes and still balance the budget.
The choice in this election is stark and simple. Senator Obama will raise your taxes. I won't. I will cut them where I can.
And Senator Obama says McCain's tax cuts will make matters worse.
So his policies would actually add more than $2 or $3 trillion to the national debt over the next decade and weaken our economy even further.
And so the debate goes on. Both candidates favor tax cuts for middle-class workers, but Senator Obama wants to increase tax cuts for top earners. And that's a look at your news.
Thank you, Femi.
Oh, you're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, now featuring Father's Day, a short film about a woman whose father left her when she was a child, and her daughter, who now wants to meet her estranged grandfather, if he lives long enough. Available at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, July 8th. Stephen Dubner, author, co-author of the Freakonomics book and blog, is still with us. And we just talked to him about Haiti briefly and political instability. And we turn again to Haiti for the story of human trafficking. It's a real problem in that country. ABC News' Dan Harris set out to find out just how hard it is to buy a child. His report shows not very hard at all. His story is called How to Buy a Slave in 10 Hours. Welcome, Dan. He started in New York City by the end of the day in Port-au-Prince, Haiti. Listen closely. We're going to listen to sound from his hidden camera that captured his deal for an 11-year-old girl.
So how much will it cost me to get a child?
The last one he gave was $300.
$300 U.S. What about
$100?
Okay, $150.
And there it is. 10 hours after leaving Manhattan, I have successfully cut a deal to buy another human being, an 11-year-old girl whose value is set at just $150.
We welcome Dan Harris this morning.
He haggled. Oh, my God.
Yeah, tell us about how you got to that moment and what was it like haggling for a human being.
I'm going to use the overused word surreal because there really isn't any other description. We're sitting by the side of a pool, broad daylight, waiters walking by, a bottle of Evian at the table, fruit plate, and here comes this man who claims to be a former member of parliament. He's got plenty of connections. He can get me a child any age, any sex, as soon as tomorrow. And it's hard to process that reality in the moment. It was only the next day when I went out and actually met slaves and their owners who shockingly were willing to go on camera and talk about it, that it really, the reality of the situation fully set in with me.
Let me just ask you one quick question before we get to more of that, just because I know you. And watching you ask, well, how about $100? That seemed to, knowing you, your body language, it clearly was bothering you.
Yeah, I was uncomfortable. I mean,
very uncomfortable.
In the wide shots I was noticing yesterday, my leg is sort of squirming around.
And your thumbs were twitching.
Yeah.
Which is not you.
No.
You weren't trying to impress your mother that you were a really good shopper, I suppose.
No. Yeah. No, that would not impress my mom.
No. Well, you know, it's amazing because it reveals so much about the economics of the entire slave industry, that there's a price issue, there's a supply distribution issue, and what really you show in this whole Nightline story is the extent to which human trafficking has acquired a kind of economic subculture of its own.
I think that's true. I mean, what we were hoping to show is that there is, and I'm comfortable using this word, an epidemic of child slavery raging right under America's nose. We're talking about 700 miles from Miami, an hour flight from Miami, 3.5 hours from New York City, 300,000 child slaves, according to UNICEF. That is an enormous number, and that is right under our nose.
And you met two of them.
I met two of them. One of them is an 8-year-old girl named Onise, who is so beautiful it breaks your heart. And another is an 11-year-old girl by the name of T-Sir, which in Haitian Creole means little sister. Both of them had scars up and down the inside of their forearms, had been beaten by electrical cords by their owners, work from night. From the moment they wake up until the minute they go to bed, and do not go to school.
And this is not necessarily just a market transaction. In other words, there is some sense from the people who buy these young girls that they're doing the young girls a favor. And some of their families, many of the girls come from rural areas, feel like they're sending their child to a better place.
Short dose of history, very short dose of history. And this is very well laid out in a new book called A Crime So Monstrous by Ben Skinner.
He was your collaborator on this.
Yes, we got the idea to do this from Ben. And essentially, generations ago, in this country, which, by the way, is the first republic in modern history, founded on a slave revolt in 1804. So there's a bleak irony here. In this country, generations ago, a tradition started whereby poor parents from the countryside would send their children into wealthier families in the city on the understanding that they would be educated in this country where there are no public schools to this day to speak of. That tradition, which was a sort of social compact, has morphed over time, devolved into a grotesque situation where ignorant, underfed, undereducated, and duped parents from the countryside are talked into giving up their children by these slave traffickers.
Well, that's as a journalist and as a documentarian, where does the moral lapse end and the economic desperation begin? Can you see it? Is there a way to disentangle them?
That's a terrific question, and it's so case by case that it's impossible to suss out. I mean, with one of the mothers we met while we were there, she knew, she had heard rumors that her child was being abused. But she was powerless to do anything about it because her new husband, who was not the biological father of the daughter, who had forced her to give the daughter away, was abusing her and refused to let her go see her child. And it wasn't until we came and told her firsthand what we had seen that she did something extraordinary. As you'll see in the show, she forced her husband to make a change.
Dan Harris, thank you. Dan Harris is an ABC correspondent. His report, How to Buy a Slave in 10 Hours, airs tonight on Nightline. Now for more headlines from Femi Oke. Femi?
Hello there, Dora. Just coming up to 22 minutes to the hour. An Afghan official says his government has evidence that Pakistani intelligence agents were behind yesterday's bombing of the Indian embassy in Kabul. The Church of England has voted to allow women to become bishops. And the German industrial giant Siemens says it will cut more than 16,000 jobs worldwide. That's more than 4% of its workforce. And both John McCain and Barack Obama will address a League of Latino Voters in Washington this afternoon. Despite their focus on global warming at the G8 summit today, world leaders are calling for an increase in worldwide oil production to bring down soaring fuel prices. Israel and the Lebanon-based militant group Hezbollah have agreed to a prisoner swap. Hezbollah will return two Israeli soldiers they kidnapped 2 years ago. The incident sparked a 34-day war with Israel, and the two Israeli soldiers are presumed dead. A senior British security official says that the Russian state was involved in the murder of a Russian dissident, Alexander Litvinenko. Litvinenko was poisoned in 2006, and British intelligence says that a Russian agent planned to assassinate another Kremlin critic last summer. Dissident Berezovsky says that Scotland Yard warned him about the threat.
They informed me that this man came here to kill me and my life is in danger here.
Intelligence officials arrested the man before they could get to Berezovsky. And finally, pollsters at AP and Yahoo have come up with another groundbreaking political tidbit. Apparently, pet owners favour John McCain 42% to Barack Obama's 37%. Dog lovers in particular were behind McCain.
I guess the GOP is sending pets to voters free of charge.
I think they sit around in the office and think, what crazy poll should we come up with today?
What's your favorite summer song?
It's going to be from Porgy and Bess and Summertime. Isn't that a beautiful song?
I love it. It's a very beautiful song.
Ellen Fitzgerald.
I wonder if it came out in the...
There are many versions.
Song, many versions of it, that's right. We've been asking you for the definitive songs of the summer. Here's one.
Hi, good morning. Yes, my name is Carla. I live in Baltimore, but I'm from Brooklyn. And my summer song is The Long Walk by Jill Scott. Let's take a long walk
around the park after... The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
That would be Rihanna. There's no umbrella.
My kids were singing that song all last summer. They're still singing it now. It was the summer song of 2007.
The summer song. But right. This year it's a little bit harder to pin down. And we're talking about that one song that DJs play nearly every night on the radio and a dance club. The one song everyone is talking about. And there is no agreement this time around, though there are many contenders. We asked our DJ friend in Atlanta. In his mind, there's no question that it's Lil Wayne season.
How you doing? This is Murph Dog, WVPS-FM, 95.5 The Beat in ATL, Georgia. Most definitely, the hot pick of the summer has got to be the Lil Wayne. Lil Weezy F. Baby. Lollipop.
So is it Lollipop 2008, Summertime in Croatia? It is, because it's actually number one on the charts there, and it's doing really well here in the U.S. and
Lollipop's
in Europe.
Trying to do that umbrella thing, just sort of repeating it over and over and over
again. Would your kids like that
My kids would go for Lollipop, Lollipop. I can just see them bobbing their heads and wandering around the living room.
Well, we asked you to be a DJ, and boy, did we get some responses. Here's a thought on what the best definitive summer song is.
Yes, my name is Brian Clark. I'm calling from Boston, and my summer song is Summer Madness by Kool & the Gang.
Brian Clark, Kool & the Gang.
He's got a great voice, and it
good
is
guy.
A great song.
Love
it's actually
guy.
My favorite summer song, too. And before he was Hancock, he was a musician. Remember that when Will Smith
he had a sitcom,
to a
too. Will Smith's done everything.
And he did that version of Summertime, and somebody really liked it.
Yes, good morning. Claudia Turner from Baltimore, Maryland. My summertime song is Will Smith's Summertime.
And what summer without thinking of California weather?
Hi, my name is Don, and I'm calling from Cedar Grove, New Jersey. And my all-time favorite summer song is California Dreaming by the Mamas and the Papas. Great song.
All these are great.
They are.
All
we have
are
more. Yeah. We're not done yet. What about the Beach Boys? Mark in Westport, Connecticut says to us, there is only one definitive summer song. It is...
Let him name it. Oh, wait, that's right. You have to. It's not a spin. That's right. I totally blew
it. It is All Summer Long by the Beach Boys.
All Summer Long. That's a great one.
So we want to know, what's your summer song?
Takes me back.
What's your summer song? What's
we
yours?
We want your picks for this year's song.
What's yours?
It was Summertime by Kool & the Gang.
That's yours.
Absolutely,
that is yours.
I think of Summertime no matter what month of the year I hear that song.
Mine is 1983, the Police album Synchronicity, which was like everywhere, every step you take.
Couldn't
I mean, all the songs were summer songs. If I hear those tunes now, I think of the summer in Virginia when I lived there.
So I think it might depend on where you go.
Everybody's got
this
one.
This summer.
Or two,
and
or
how
six.
Old you are. You think that about sums it up?
8778 My Take. That's how to reach us to DJ us. Or you can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Can we hear more of that Kool & the Gang?
Yep, they're punching it up as we speak. We enjoy that Kool & the Gang.
Summer Madness.
Summer Madness.
Yeah. There you go.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
So we were talking about the economy at the beginning of the hour with Stephen Dubner. He's author of the Freakonomics book and the blog. Steve's still with us. We thought we would take a look at an economy or an industry that is maybe doing a little better than the auto industry. And in the brewing economy, the word of the summer is merger, consolidation. Last week, Miller and Coors announced they had successfully combined their two companies. Meanwhile, the Belgian concern InBev continues its venture to take over Anheuser-Busch. If that happens, virtually all of the beer industry would be under the control of two companies. Steve Hindy is the founder of the Brooklyn Brewery, home of Brooklyn Lager, and I'm a big fan. Steve Hindy, what does all this consolidation mean?
Yeah, it's very interesting because what's happening in the beer industry is the big are getting bigger and the small are getting bigger as well. Let me explain that. I started in business 20 years ago, as did many craft brewers across the country. At that time, the big national breweries in the U.S. controlled about 95% of the market. Imports were about 4%, and craft beer was, you know, hardly a blip on the radar. Today, imports are about 14%. Craft beer is around 4 or 5%. And as you said in your intro, the big guys, two of them now, are 80%. So they're getting bigger, but actually their share of the pie is shrinking a bit.
But it sounds like a growing pie for all of you. The recession really doesn't seem to have hurt the beer industry from what you're describing.
Well, part of the problem in the beer industry is it's not a growing pie. The People are drinking less beer, but they're drinking better beer. So they're drinking imported beer, they're drinking craft beer, as opposed to mainstream beer.
The more expensive stuff.
That's right. And that is an area where InBev has been very successful in selling their Stella brand here in the U.S. as a premium beer. In Belgium, it's kind of a run-of-the-mill beer. And in selling Bass and taking over Beck's and, you know, now attempting to take over Anheuser-Busch.
Steve, this is Stephen Dubner. I wonder what about commodity prices. Barley, we've read about barley shortages around the world. Is that having a big effect on you?
Yeah, that's putting a big hurt on small brewers because we don't enjoy the buying power or the economies of scale that the big guys do. Our Brooklyn Brewery's barley prices have gone up by about 70% since November, and our hop prices have gone up as much as 300%.
And there are similar issues with water as well, depending on where you are in the world. I'm wondering if the economy of scale actually works at the scale of InBev taking over Anheuser-Busch. I mean, how much of a premium do they get on barley and other commodity prices by combining versus being huge and separate?
Well, I don't know. I think that's probably measured in pennies on the barrel. But when you're talking about a couple of hundred million barrels, it's a significant amount of money. I think, you know, their challenge is to get bigger and bigger and still manage to be kind of, an American company, a human face on the company.
Right. Well, we're gonna leave it there, Steve. Quickly, do you have a summer song?
I always liked Hot Town Summer in the City.
All right. No, that's a good one. Steve Hindy, founder of the Brooklyn Brewery from Brooklyn, New York, talking about consolidation in the beer industry.
It's interesting how quickly those songs just roll off of everyone's lips.
Everyone's got one.
Well, in Beijing, they would wish clean air would be rolling off the lips of officials as they talk about the Olympics, which are slated to begin exactly 30 days from today. But as the countdown to D-Day has begun, the city is still failing to meet international air quality standards. Right now, we're joined on the line by BBC correspondent James Reynolds, who has actually tested the air. Welcome, James. How polluted is it?
Well, what was it? Willie Nelson said, blue skies, nothing but blue skies. He wouldn't see that here. We tested for 7 days in Beijing. We found that on one day, Beijing met the WHO's preferred guideline, the preferred guideline for airborne particles. On 4 days, it met a much easier interim target set by the World Health Organization. But on 2 days, we found that the pollution levels here were dramatically above any WHO standards. We've spoken to scientists who say that if this carries on, endurance events should be rescheduled.
Exactly, because there has been a tremendous amount of concern on the part of athletes, say if you're running a marathon or 100 meters or even doing some swimming. There have been reports that some athletes were working out in the midst of some kind of pollution. But I guess the real question here is China has reportedly spent somewhere around $40 billion preparing for this Olympics. Clearly, clean air was at the top of the agenda. Why isn't it cleaner? And do you think they'll be ready come August 8th?
Right. The real point here is that in trying to look good for the games, Beijing has made its air look bad. It's built so many buildings that there is so much dust in the air and particles in the air that the air is clogged up. So in trying to look good for everyone who's coming, it's actually made its situation worse. Well, that's the problem it's facing.
James, maybe they should actually change the events a little bit. Instead of the marathon, it should be the sulfur dioxide marathon.
Or the 5-meter sprint.
Right, the 5-meter sprint. Yeah, that would work. I can imagine what it's like to breathe the air in Beijing, but to run 100, it seems like you would do permanent damage to yourself.
Scientists we've spoken to say you wouldn't do permanent damage, but you would do acute temporary damage, i.e. if you ran the marathon, you'd feel pretty painful. But I should say that Beijing is going to impose some temporary emergency measures. Essentially, in a few weeks' time, it's going to tell this city to stop. It's going to take cars off the roads. It's going to shut down building and construction sites. It's giving itself 19 days for the particles and the dust to settle so that
James,
it'll be Nelson-style
blue skies. James, how do they know that will work?
They don't. They're hoping that it will. We've spoken to scientists who say that it's now down to fate, because here's the problem. Beijing's in a bowl. It's surrounded by mountains, and the fate for the pollution relies on the wind. Sometimes the wind blows away Beijing's pollution, but here's the critical one. Sometimes it blows in pollution from neighboring provinces. If that happens during the Olympic Games, there is nothing the government can do about it.
But with the history of China, I mean, you got the Long March, you got the Cultural Revolution. I mean, you could imagine the Chinese government saying, everybody stand outside with some cardboard and start, like, waving, and we're going to blow the dust away.
They've also been trying to make weather there for years. Do they have any big fans in the sky ready to go?
They have cloud seeding techniques, which is where they go and fire rockets, I think, into the clouds to seed them with water to flush out the pollution. But here's the problem. We've had lots of rain in the last week or two, and occasionally you have blue skies, but more often than not, you simply have haze. So it's coming down to these last-minute measures where people will have to stop their cars, stop building sites. You're not even allowed to spray paint outside from July the 20th. But that's the problem. In order for the skies to be blue, this city has to stop. And that is not a long-term strategy.
James Reynolds, thank you very much. James Reynolds is a BBC correspondent, and he was reporting from Beijing.
Chinese are saying, really glad we did that Olympics thing. That's really working for us. Yeah, definitely.
Well, we'll watch that, and we'll keep updating that and see what happens. But right now, we're going to ask folks to keep your responses coming to anything you've heard on today's show. Send us your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We're talking about global warming, child slavery, and why there's no summer song yet.
Not in 2008, but man, you've been giving us your songs. And also, we want to say thank you to Chopin fanatic Stephen Dubner from Freakonomics for joining us. And we heard from so many of you what song is the soundtrack for your summer.
Hi, my name's Ron, and I'm calling from the Boston area. And my summertime song is Katrina and the Waves, Walking on Sunshine.
That's a good one.
That's a good one.
We like to walk on sunshine. Ken, on our website, thetakeaway.org, said, if you want a taste of summer, even while shoveling snow in the middle of January, listen to Angelique Kidjo's version of Porgy and Bess's Summertime. Ken says she owns that song.
Oh, that's nice. It's like, some of you wanted to comment on James Reynolds' report on the amount of pollution in Beijing as we lead up to the Olympics. One of you had a pretty personal experience you wanted to share.
Hi, this is Nathaniel Bryce. I'm from New Jersey. I was in Beijing for Christmas this year, and as soon as I got off the airplane, we were hit by haze inside the airport. We didn't even have to leave the airport before we were blown away by the pollution. Kind of crazy.
And he's from New Jersey.
That's I'm not. Okay. The takeaway today is...
I'll open the mail.
Predicting the future is a fool's game.
Predicting the future is a fool's game.
That's Stephen Dubner. Again, we thank him for joining us. I'll open the email. I'll open all the mail from New Jersey. On our website, you can check out our new Facebook game, the 2008 Veep Stakes, buy and sell potential running mates for Barack Obama. We're on YouTube, iTunes, and Facebook. Join the discussion any way you want. 877-8-MY-TAKE. What was your favorite album? You were like Cool in the Gang.
Summertime by Cool in the Gang, 1974.
Yeah, man. Have a great summer, everybody. But of course, we're going to be back tomorrow. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji.
It's The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.